go so easily.
Swan stared at him. The man was no fool. Why was he pretending not to understand?
I am Aes Sedai again. Do you really expect an Aes Sedai to do your laundry?
Just to drive it home, she embraced Sayadar. That mist sweetness was so wonderful she shivered, wrapped him in flows of air and lifted him. Tried to lift him. Gaping, she drew more, tried harder, until the sweetness stabbed like a thousand hooks. His boots never stirred from the floor. It was impossible. True, the simple act of picking something up was one of the hardest in channeling, but she had been able to lift nearly three times her own weight.
"Is this supposed to impress me?" Bryn said calmly. "Or frighten me? Shiriam and her friends gave their word. The hall gave its word. And more importantly, you gave yours, Swan. I wouldn't let you get away from me if you were the Amarlin again. Now undo whatever it is you've done, or when I get free of it, I'll turn you upside down and smack you for being childish. You're very seldom childish, so you needn't think I will let you start now."
In a near daze, she released the source. Not for his threat. He was capable of it. He had done it before. But not for that, and not for shock at being unable to pick him up. Tears seemed to well up in her like a fountain. She hoped that letting go of Sayadar might stop them. A few still slid down her cheeks, though, however hard she blinked. Gareth was cupping her face in his hands before she knew he had moved.
"Light woman, don't tell me I frightened you. I didn't think being dropped in a pit with a pack of leopards would frighten you."
"I'm not frightened," she said stiffly. Good. She could still lie. Tears building inside.
"We have to work out some way not to be at one another's throat all the time," he said quietly.
"There is no reason for us to work out anything." They were coming. They were coming. Oh, Light, she could not let him see. "Just leave me alone, please, please, just go."
For a wonder, he hesitated only a moment before doing as she asked.
With the sound of his boots behind her, she managed to make it around the corner into the crossing hallway before the dam burst, and she sank to her knees, weeping piteously. She knew what it was now. Ulrich, her warder. Her dead warder, murdered when Elida deposed her. She could lie, the three oaths were still gone, but some part of her bond to Ulrich, a bond flesh to flesh and mind to mind, had been resurrected. The pain of his death, the pain first masked by the shock of what Elida intended, and then buried by stilling, that pain filled her to the brim. Huddled against the wall, bawling, she was only glad Gareth was not seeing this. "I have no time to fall in love, burn him." The thought was a bucket of cold water in her face. The pain remained, but the tears stopped and she scrambled to her feet. Love? That was as impossible as... She could not think of anything impossible enough. The man was impossible. Suddenly she realized Lyanna was standing not two paces away, watching. Swan made one effort at wiping the tears from her face, then gave it up. There was nothing but sympathy on Lyanna's face. "How did you deal with Anjan's death, Lyanna?" That had been 15 years ago now. "I cried," Lyanna said. "For a month I held it in during the day and spent the night in a quivering ball of tears in the middle of my bed, after I had torn the sheets to shreds. For 3 more I could find tears in my eyes without warning. Over a year passed before I stopped hurting. That's why I never bonded another. I did not think I could live through that again. It does pass, Swan." She found a roguish smile somewhere. "Now I think I could manage 2 or 3 warders, if not 4. Swan nodded. She could cry at night. As for Gareth Bloody Bryn, there was no as for. There was not. Do you think they're ready? They had had only a moment to talk below. This hook had to be set quickly, or it would not be set at all. Perhaps. I did not have much time. And I had to be careful. Lyanna paused. "Are you sure you want to go through with this, Swan? It's changing everything we have worked for, on no notice at all, and I am not as strong as I was, Swan, and neither are you. Most of the women here can channel more than either of us now. Light, I think some of the accepted can, not even counting Elaine or Nynaeve.
I know, Swan said. It had to be risked. The other plan had only been a stopgap, because she was no longer Aes Sedai. But now she was Aes Sedai again, and she had been deposed with only the barest nod to Tower law.
If she was Aes Sedai again, was she not Amyrlin again as well? Squaring her shoulders, she went below to do battle with the hall. Lying on her bed in her shift, Elaine stifled a yawn and went back to rubbing the cream Lyanna had given her into her hands. It seemed to do some good. At least they felt softer. A night breeze stirred through the window, making the lone candle flicker. If anything, the air only made the room hotter. Nynaeve staggered in, banged the door shut, flung herself across her bed, and lay staring at Elaine.
Magla is the most contemptible, hateful, low woman in the entire world, she mumbled. No, Larissa is. No, it's Romanda.
I take it they made you angry enough to channel,
Nynaeve grunted with the vilest expression, and Elaine hurried on.
How many did you demonstrate for? I expected you long ago. I looked for you at dinner, but I couldn't find you.
I had a roll at dinner, Nynaeve muttered. One roll. I demonstrated for all of them, every last yellow in Salidar. Only they aren't satisfied. They want me one at a time. They've set up a rotating schedule. Larissa has me tomorrow morning before breakfast, and Zanair right after. Then they discussed how to make me angry as if I was not there.
She raised her head from the coverlet, looking hunted.
Elaine, they are competing over who is going to break my block. They're like boys trying to catch a greased pig on feast day, and I am the pig.
Yawning, Elaine handed her the pot of hand cream, and after a moment Nynaeve rolled over and began rubbing it on. Nynaeve still had her time at the pots, too.
I'm sorry I didn't do as you wanted days ago, Nynaeve. We could have woven disguises like Mogedians and walked right past everybody.
Nynaeve's hands stopped.
What is the matter, Nynaeve?
I never thought of that.
I never thought of it!
You didn't? I was sure you had. You learned it first, after all.
I tried not even to think about what we couldn't tell the sisters. Nynaeve's voice was flat as ice and about as cold and hard. And now it is too late. I'm too tired to channel if you set my hair on fire, and if they have their way, I will be too tired forever. The only reason they let me go tonight was that I couldn't find Saidar, even when Nisau... She shuddered, and then her hands began moving again, smoothing in the cream. Elaine let out a small breath. She had very nearly put her foot in it. She was tired, too. Admitting you had been wrong always made the other person feel better, but she hadn't meant to mention using Saidar for disguises. From the first she had been afraid Nynaeve would do that. Here, at the very least, they could keep an eye on what the Salidar Aes Sedai intended, and maybe pass word to Ran through Egwene once she returned to Tel Iron Riod. At the worst, they might have some small influence through Swan and Lyanna. As if the thought were a summons, the door opened to admit just those women. Lyanna carried a wooden tray with bread and a bowl of soup, a red pottery cup and a white glazed pitcher. There was even a sprig of green leaves in a tiny blue vase.
Swan and I thought you might be hungry, Nynaeve. I hear the yellows used you hard.
Elaine was uncertain whether she should rise or not. It was just Swan and Lyanna, but they were Aes Sedai again. At least she thought they were. The two solved the problem by sitting, Swan on the foot of Elaine's bed, Lyanna on Nynaeve's. Nynaeve eyed them both suspiciously before sitting up with her back against the wall and taking the tray on her knees.
"I heard a rumor you addressed the hall, Swan," Elaine said carefully. "Should we have curtsied?"
"Do you mean, are we Aes Sedai again, girl?" "We are. They wrangled like fishwives on Sunday, but they granted that much at least."
Swan exchanged glances with Lyanna, and Swan's cheeks colored faintly. Elaine suspected she would never learn what had not been granted.
"Mirella was kind enough to find me and let me know,"
Liana said into the momentary silence.
"I think I am going to choose green."
Nynaeve choked around her spoon.
"What do you mean? Can you change Aja's?"
"No, you cannot," Swan told her. "But what the Hall decided is that although we are Aes Sedai, for a time we weren't. And since they insist on believing that Cod's Wallop was legal, all our ties, binds, associations, and titles went overboard."
Her voice was wry enough to rasp wood.
"Tomorrow I ask the Blues whether they'll have me back. I've never heard of an Aja turning anybody down. By the time you're raised from accepted, you've been guided to the right Aja, whether you know it or not. But the way matters are proceeding, I wouldn't be completely surprised if they slammed the door on my foot."
"How are matters proceeding?" Elaine asked.
"There was something here. Swan bullied, prodded, twisted your arm. She did not bring soup, sit on your bed, and chat like a friend."
"I thought everything was going as well as could be expected."
Nynaeve gave her a stare that managed to be incredulous and haggard at the same time.
"Well, Nynaeve ought to know what she meant."
Swan twisted around to face her, but she included Nynaeve as well. "I went by Loghain's house. 6 sisters are maintaining his shield, the same as when he was captured. He tried to break free when he found out we knew he had been healed, and they said if only 5 had been holding the shield, he might have. So he's as strong as he ever was, or close enough to make no difference. I'm not. Neither is Liana. I want you to try again, Nynaeve."
"I knew it!" Nynaeve flung her spoon down on the tray. "I knew you had some reason for this. Well, I'm too tired to channel, and it wouldn't matter if I wasn't. You can't heal what has been healed. You get out of here and take your vile-tasting soup with you."
Less than half the vile-tasting soup remained, and it was a big bowl.
"I know it will work," Swan snapped back. "This morning I knew Stilling couldn't be healed."
"A moment, Swan," Liana said.
"Nynaeve, do you realize what we are risking coming here together? This isn't a room in an alley with your archer friend standing guard. There are women all through this house with eyes to see and tongues to talk. If it is found out that Swan and I have been playing a game with everybody, even 10 years from now, well, suffice it to say, Aes Sedai can be given penance, and we would very likely still be on a farm hoeing cabbages after our hair turns white. We came because of what you did for us, to make a fresh start."
"Why didn't you go to one of the Yellows?" Elaine asked. "Most of them must know as much about it as Nynaeve by now."
Nynaeve glared indignantly around the spoon.
"Vile tasting?"
Swan and Liana exchanged looks, and at last Swan said reluctantly, "If we go to a sister, everybody knows, soon or late.
If Nynaeve does it, maybe anybody who managed to weigh us today will think they were mistaken. Supposedly all sisters are equal, and there have been Amerlins who barely managed to channel enough to earn the shawl. But Amerlins and the heads of Ajas aside, by custom, if another is stronger in the power than you, you're expected to give way to her."
"I don't understand," Elaine said. She was getting quite a lesson out of this. The hierarchy made sense, but she supposed it was one of those things you did not learn until you actually were Aes Sedai. One way and another, she had picked up enough hints to suspect that in many ways your education only began when you put on the shawl.
"If Nynaeve can heal you again, then you're stronger."
Liana shook her head. "No one has ever been healed from Stilling before. Maybe the others will see it, say, like being wilders. That puts you a little lower than your strength. Maybe having been weaker will count something. If Nynaeve couldn't heal us all the way the first time, maybe she'll only take us to 2/3 what we were, or half. Even that would be better than now, but still most here would be as strong and a good many stronger."
Elaine stared, more confused than before. Nynaeve looked as if she had been hit between the eyes.
"Everything goes into it," Swan explained. "Who learned fastest? Who spent the least time as novice and accepted? There are all sorts of shadings. You can't say precisely how strong anyone is. 2 women might seem to be the same strength. Maybe they are, and maybe not, but the only way to say for certain would be a duel, and the light be blessed, we're above that.
Unless Nynaeve returns us to our full strength, we run the risk of standing fairly low. Lyanna took it up again. The hierarchy isn't supposed to rule anything except everyday life, but it does. Advice from somebody with higher standing is given more weight than from somebody with lower. It did not matter while we were stilled. We had no standing at all. They weighed what we said on merit alone. It will not be that way now.
I see, Elaine said faintly.
No wonder people thought Aes Sedai invented the game of houses. They made Desdemar look simple. It's nice to see that healing you gave somebody more trouble than it did me, Nynaeve grumbled. Peering into the bottom of the bowl, she sighed, then wiped it out with the last bit of bread. Swan's face darkened, but she managed to keep her voice level.
You can see, we lay ourselves bare. And not just to convince you to try healing again. You gave me back my life. As simple as that. I had convinced myself I wasn't dead, but it certainly seems so compared to this. So we make Lyanna's fresh start. Friends, if you'll have me for one. If not, then crewmates in the same boat.
Friends, Elaine said. Friends sounds much better to me. Lyanna smiled at her, but she and Swan were still watching Nynaeve. Nynaeve peered from one to the other. Elaine had a question, so I should have one. What did Shiryam and the others learn from the Wise Ones last night? Don't say you do not know, Swan. As far as I'm concerned, you know what they think an hour after they think it. Swan's jaw set stubbornly. Those deep blue eyes set themselves to intimidate. Suddenly she yelped and bent to rub her ankle. Tell them, Lyanna said, drawing back her foot. Or I will. All of it, Swan. Glaring at Lyanna, Swan puffed up till Elaine thought she might burst. But then her gaze touched Nynaeve, and she deflated. Words came out as though dragged, but they came. The embassy from Elida has reached Kyrian. Rand's met them, but he seems to be trying to toy with them. At least let us hope that is what he's doing. Shiryam and the others are set up because for once they managed not to make fools of themselves with the Wise Ones. And Egwene will be at the next meeting. For some reason, that last seemed to come most reluctantly of all. Nynaeve brightened, sitting up straighter. Egwene? Oh, that's wonderful. So they didn't come off as fools for once. I half wondered why they were not here to drag us off for another lesson. She squinted at Swan, but even the squint looked cheerful. A boat, you say? Who's the captain? I am, you wretched little... Lyanna cleared her throat, and Swan took a deep breath. A share crew, then. Equal shares. But someone has to steer, she added when Nynaeve began to smile, and that will be me. All right, Nynaeve said after a long moment. Another hesitation, fiddling with her spoon. Then, in a voice so casual, Elaine wanted to throw up her hands. Is there any chance you might help me, us, get us out of the kitchens? They had faces no older than Nynaeve's, but they had been Aes Sedai for a long time. Their eyes remembered that Aes Sedai stare. Nynaeve met it more steadily than Elaine thought she could have, except for just a bit of shifting. But in the end it was no surprise when she muttered, I suppose not. We have to be going, Swan said, standing. If anything, Lyanna understated the cost of discovery. We could be the first Aes Sedai skinned publicly, and I've already been the only first I want to. To Elaine's surprise, Lyanna bent to hug her, whispering, Friends. Elaine returned the hug and the word warmly. Lyanna also hugged Nynaeve, murmuring something Elaine could not hear, and then Swan did too, with a thank you that sounded gruff and reluctant. At least that was how it sounded to her, but once they were gone, Nynaeve said, She was about to cry, Elaine. Maybe she really meant all of that. I suppose I should try to be nicer to her. She sighed, which became a yawn, muffling, Especially since she's Aes Sedai again. And with that, she fell asleep, with the tray still on her knees. Muffling a yawn of her own behind her hand, Elaine got up and squared everything away neatly, tucking the tray under Nynaeve's bed. It took a little time to get Nynaeve out of her dress and settled down into the bed more comfortably, but even that did not wake her. For herself, once Elaine had the candle snuffed and was hugging her pillow, she lay awake, staring at the darkness and thinking. Rand trying to deal with Aes Sedai sent by Elaida? They would eat him alive. Almost she wished she could have seen her way to accepting Nynaeve's suggestion when it had a chance of success. She could guide him through any snares they set, she was sure. Tom had added a great deal to what her mother taught her, and he would listen to her. Besides, that way she could bond him. After all, she had not waited until she wore the shawl to bond Birgitta. Why wait for Rand? Shifting, she snuggled deeper into her pillow. He had to wait. He was in Camelon, not Salidar. Wait. Swan said he was in Cairhien.
How?
She was too tired. The thought drifted. Swan. Swan was still hiding something. She was sure of it. Sleep slid in, and with it a dream. A boat with Lyanna sitting in the bow, flirting with a man whose face was different every time Elaine looked. In the stern, Swan and Nynaeve were struggling, each trying to steer in a different direction, until Elaine stood up and took charge. A captain keeping secrets could be reason enough for a mutiny if need be. In the morning, Swan and Lyanna returned before Nynaeve even opened her eyes, more than sufficient to make her angry enough to channel. It did no good, though. What was already healed could not be healed again. "I will do what I can, Swan," Delana said, leaning forward to pat the other woman's arm. They were alone in the sitting room, and the teacups on the small table between their chairs stood untouched. Swan sighed, looking dejected, though what she could expect after her outburst in front of the hall Delana did not know. Early morning light spilled through the windows, and she thought of the breakfast she had not had yet. But this was Swan. The situation was disconcerting, and Delana did not like being disconcerted. She had schooled herself not to see her old friend in this woman's face. Not hard, since she looked nothing at all like the Swan Sanche Delana remembered. Not at any age. Yet seeing Swan again, a Swan young and pretty, was only the first shock. The second was Swan appearing on her doorstep with the sun not up, asking help. Swan never asked for help. And then there was the biggest shock of all, the one renewed every time she came face to face with Swan since the Almira woman had worked her impossible miracle. She was stronger than Swan, much stronger. The margin had always gone the other way. Swan had taken the lead when they were novices, even before they were accepted. Still, she was Swan, and upset, which Delana never remembered before. Swan could be upset, but she never let you see it. It distressed her that she could not do more for the woman who had stolen honey cakes with her, and more than once had taken the blame for pranks they had both been involved in. "Swan, I can do this much, at least. Romanda would be more than happy to take those dream Turangrial into the hall's keeping. She doesn't have enough sitters with her to bring it off, but if Shiriam thinks she does, if she thinks you've used your influence with Lelaine and me to stop it, then she won't be able to refuse you. I know Lelaine will agree. Though why you want to meet these Aiel women I cannot imagine." Romanda smiles like a cat in the buttery, watching Shiriam stalk around in a temper after one of those meetings. "With your temper you will likely burst something." Such a change. Once she would never have thought of mentioning Swan's temper. Now she mentioned it without thinking. Swan's downcast face broke into a smile. "I hoped you would do something like that. I will speak to Lelaine. And Janya. I think Janya will help. You have to make sure Romanda doesn't actually do it, though. From the little I know, Shiriam has worked out at least a semblance of how to get along with these Aiel. I'm afraid Romanda would need to start from the beginning. Of course, that might not be important to the hall, but I would just as soon not have my first look at them when everybody has a hook in their gills." Delana kept her smile inside as she escorted Swan to the front step and gave her a hug. Yes, it would be very important to the hall to keep the wise ones pacific, though Swan had no way of knowing that. She watched Swan hurry down the street before going back in. It seemed she was going to be the one doing the protecting now. She hoped she made as good a job of it as her friend had. The tea was still warm, and she decided to send Miesa, her serving woman, for some rolls and fruit, but when a timid tap came at the sitting-room door, it was not Miesa, but Lucilda, one of the novices they had brought from the tower. The lanky girl bobbed a nervous curtsy, but Lucilda was always nervous.
"Delana," said I, "a woman arrived this morning, and Anaya," said I should bring her over to you. "Her name's Halima Saranoff. She says she knows you."
Delana opened her mouth to say that she had never heard of any Halima Saranoff, and the woman appeared in the doorway. Delana stared in spite of herself. The woman managed to be slender and lush at the same time, and wore a dark gray riding dress cut ridiculously low. Long, lustrous black hair framed a green-eyed face that probably made every man who glimpsed it gape. That was not why Delana stared, of course. The woman held her hands at her sides, but with thumbs thrust hard between the first two fingers. Delana had never expected to see that from any woman who did not wear the shawl, and this Halima Saranoff could not even channel. She was close enough to be sure of that. "Yes," Delana said. "It seems to me I do remember. Leave us, Lucilda. And, child, do try to remember that every sentence isn't a question." Lucilda bobbed a curtsy so quick and deep that she nearly fell. Under other circumstances, Delana would have sighed. She had never done well with novices, though she could not understand why. Almost before the novice was out of the room, Halima swayed over to the chair Swan had used and sat without a word of invitation. Picking up one of the untouched cups, she crossed her legs and sipped, watching Delana over the rim. Delana fixed her with a hard stare. "Who do you think you are, woman? However high you think you stand, none stand higher than Aes Sedai. And where did you learn that sign?" For perhaps the first time in her life, that stare did no good. Halima smiled at her mockingly. "Do you really think the secrets of the, shall we say, darker Aja are that secret? As for how high you stand, you know very well that if a beggar gave the proper signs, you would leap to obey. My story is that I was traveling companion for a time to one Cabriana Macanda's, a blue sister. Unfortunately, Cabriana died in a fall from her horse, and her warder simply refused to leave his blankets or eat after that. He died, too." Halima smiled as if to ask whether Delana was following. "Cabriana and I talked a great deal before she died, and she told me about Salidar. She also told me a number of things she had learned about the White Tower's plans for you here, and for the Dragon Reborn." Another smile, a quick flash of white teeth, and she went back to her tea and her watching. Delana had never been a woman to give up easily. She had bludgeoned kings into making peace when they wanted war, dragged queens by the scruff of the neck to sign treaties that had to be signed. True, she would have obeyed that hypothetical beggar if he had the proper signs and said the right things, but Halima's hands had identified her as Black Aja, which she clearly was not. Perhaps the woman thought that was the only way to make Delana acknowledge her, and perhaps she wanted to show off her forbidden knowledge as well. Delana did not like this Halima. "And I suppose I am supposed to make sure the hall accepts your information," she said gruffly. "It should be no problem so long as you know enough of Cabriana to support your tale. I can't help you there. I never met her above twice. I suppose there is no chance of her appearing to spoil your story?" "No chance at all." Again that quick, mocking smile. "And I could recite Cabriana's life. I know things she had forgotten herself." Delana only nodded to that. Killing a sister was always to be regretted, but what must be, must be. "Then there is no problem at all. The hall will receive you as a guest, and I can make sure they listen." "A guest is not exactly what I had in mind. Something rather more permanent, I think. Your secretary, or better yet, your companion. I need to make sure your hall is guided carefully. Beyond this tale of Cabriana's news, from time to time I'll have instructions for you. Now you listen to me. Halima cut her off without raising her voice. I was told to mention a name to you. A name I use sometimes. Arangar. Delana sat down heavily. That name had been mentioned in her dreams. For the first time in years, Delana Mosalane was afraid.
Chapter 31 Red Wax. The sound of the black gelding's hooves was all but swallowed in the noise of Amador as Eamon Valda rode slowly through the crowded streets. Sweat oozed from his every pore, the more for his perfectly polished mail and breastplate, gleaming despite a layer of dust, and the snowy cloak spread over the gelding's powerful rump. Yet it might have been a fine spring day for all the notice he took. He did his best to ignore the dirty men and women, even children, with lost expressions and travel-worn clothes. Even here. For once in his life, the great stone walls of the Fortress of the Light, towered and bannered and impregnable, bastion of truth and right, did not lift his spirits. Dismounting in the main courtyard, he tossed his reins to a child with graded instructions for caring for the animal. The man knew what to do, of course, but Valda wanted to snap at something. White-cloaked men scurried everywhere in a great show of energy despite the heat. He hoped there was something more than show behind it. Young Dane Bornhold came trotting across the courtyard, pressing fist to mailed chest in an eager salute. "The light illumine you, my lord captain. You had a good ride from Tar Valon, yes?" His eyes were bloodshot and a smell of brandy wafted from him. There was no excuse for drinking during the day. "Fast, at least," Valda growled, jerking off his gauntlets and stuffing them behind his sword belt. It was not the brandy, though he would make a mark against the man for it. The journey had been fast for that distance. He intended to give the Legion a night in the city by way of reward once they finished making camp outside the city. A fast journey, but he disapproved of the orders that called him back, just when a strong push might have toppled the crippled tower and buried the witches under the rubble. A ride to be remarked, yet every day had brought worse news. Althor and Camelin. It did not really matter whether the man was a false dragon or the real one. He could channel, and any man who did that had to be a dark friend. Dragon-sworn rabble in Altara. This so-called prophet and his scum in Gieldan, in Amadisia itself. He had managed to kill some of that filth, at least, though it was hard-fighting foes who melted away more often than they stood, who could blend into the accursed streams of refugees, and worse, of brainless wanderers who seemed to think Althor had turned all order on its head. He had found a solution, however, if not a completely satisfactory one. The roads behind his legion were littered now, and the ravens fed to bursting. If it was not possible to tell the prophet's trash from refugee trash, well then, kill whoever clogged the way. The innocent should have remained in their homes where they belonged. The Creator would shelter them anyway. As far as he was concerned, the wanderers were added plums on the cake. "I heard in the city that Morghese is here," he said. He did not believe it. Every other word in Andor had been speculation over who killed Morghese. So he was startled when Dane nodded. Surprise turned to disgust as the young man babbled about Morghese's apartments and her hunting, how well she was treated, how she was sure to sign a treaty with the children any day. Valda scowled openly. He should have expected no better from Niall. The man had been one of the best soldiers in his time, accounted a great captain. But he grew old and soft. Valda had known that as soon as his orders reached Tar Valon. Niall should have moved on Tyr in strength with the first word of Althor. He would have gathered all the numbers he needed on the march. Nations would have rallied to the children against a false dragon. They would have then. Now Althor was in Camelin, and strong enough to frighten the faint-hearted. But Morghese was here. If he had Morghese, she would sign that treaty the first day if somebody had to guide her hand to hold the pen. By the light, he would teach her to leap when he said leap. If she balked at returning to Andor with the children, he would lash her to a staff by her wrists. That would be a banner to lead the advance into Andor. Dane ran down, waiting, no doubt hoping for an invitation to dinner this evening. As a junior, he could not issue one to an officer senior to him, but doubtless he hoped to talk with his old commander, about Tarvalin, perhaps even about his dead father. Valda had not thought much of Jefferon Bornhald. The man had been soft. "I will see you at the camp for dinner at 6. I will see you sober, child Bornhald." Bornhald surely was in drink. He gaped and stammered before making his salute and going. Valda wondered what had happened. Dane had been a fine young officer, one who worried too much over niceties, such as proof of guilt when there was no way to obtain it, yet still fine for all that. Not as weak as his father. Ashamed to see him waste himself in brandy. Muttering under his breath, officers drinking in the very Fortress of the Light was another sign that Nile was rotting at the core, Valda went in search of his rooms. He intended to sleep in the camp, but a hot bath would not be amiss. A square-shouldered young child approached in the plain stone corridor, the scarlet shepherd's crook of the Hand of the Light, behind the flaring golden sun on his chest. Without stopping, or even looking at Valda, the questioner murmured respectfully, "My lord captain might wish to visit the Dome of Truth." Valda frowned after the man. He did not like questioners. They did good work in their way, yet he could never escape the feeling that they had donned the crook because that way they would never have to face an armed foe. Started to raise his voice and dress the fellow down, then stopped. Questioners were sloppy in their discipline, but a simple child would never speak idly to a lord captain. Perhaps the bath could wait. The Dome of Truth was a wonder that finally did restore some of his essence. Pure white outside, inside gold leaf cast down the light of 1,000 hanging lamps. Thick white columns ringed the chamber, plain and polished to glistening, but the dome itself stretched 100 paces across unsupported and rose 50 at its peak. Above the simple white marble dais, centered on the white marble floor, where the Lord Captain Commander of the Children of the Light stood to address the assembled children in their most solemn moments, their most serious ceremonies. He would stand there one day. Nile would not live forever. Dozens of children wandered about the vast chamber. It was a sight worth seeing, though none but the children ever did, of course. Yet that message had not come so he could admire the dome. He was sure of it. Behind the great columns ran rows of smaller ones, just as simple and polished just as highly, and tall alcoves where scenes of the children's triumphs made frescoes of 1,000 years. Valda strolled, looking into each recess. Finally he saw a tall, graying man studying one of the paintings, Serenia Latar, being raised on the scaffold, the only Amarlin the children had ever managed to hang. She had been dead already, of course, live witches being somewhat hard to hang. But that was beside the point. 693 years ago, justice had been done according to the law.
"Are you troubled, my son?"
The voice was soft, almost mild. Valda stiffened slightly. Radha Masunawa might be the High Inquisitor, but he was still a questioner, and Valda was a Lord Captain, anointed of the Light, not my son. "Not that I have noticed," he said flatly. Asunawa sighed. His gaunt face was a picture of martyred suffering, so that his sweat might have been taken for tears, but his deep-set eyes seemed to burn with the heat that had boiled away all his spare flesh. His cloak bore only the crook, no flaring golden sun, as though he stood outside the children, or perhaps above.
"The times are troubled. The Fortress of the Light harbors a witch."
Valda suppressed a wry look before it formed. Cowards or not, questioners could be dangerous, even to a Lord Captain. The man might never be able to hang an Amarlin, but he probably dreamed of being the first to hang a queen. Valda did not care whether Morghais died, provided it was not before all the use was wrung out of her. He said nothing, and Asunawa's thick gray eyebrows drew down until he seemed to peer out of caverns.
The times are troubled, he said again, and Nile must not be allowed to destroy the children of the light.
For long minutes, Valda examined the painting. Perhaps the artist had been good, perhaps not. He knew nothing of such things, and cared even less. The fellow had gotten the weapons and armor right on the guards, though, and the rope and scaffold looked real. Those were things he knew.
I am prepared to listen, he said finally. Then we will talk, my son. Later, when there are fewer eyes to see and ears to hear. The light illumine you, my son.
Asinawa strode away without another word, White Cloak billowing slightly and the sound of his boots echoing, as if he was trying to drive every step into the stone. Some of the children bowed deeply as he passed. From a narrow window high above the courtyard, Niall watched Valda dismount and speak to young Bornhold, then stalk away in a fury. Valda was always in a fury. Had there been some means to bring the children home from Tarvalen and leave Valda there, Niall would have jumped at it. The man was a fair enough battle commander, but better suited to rousing mobs. His notion of tactics was the charge, and of strategy, the charge. Shaking his head, Niall made his way to his audience chamber. He had more important things than Valda to concern him. Morghese was still resisting like an army on the heights with water and high morale. She refused to admit she held a valley floor with no way out, and it was her enemy who had the heights. Balwar rose from his table as Niall entered the anteroom.
Omerna was here, my lord. He left these for you.
Balwar touched a sheaf of papers tied with a red ribbon on the table.
And this.
Thin lips tightened as he drew a tiny bone tube from his pocket. Niall took the tube with a mutter and stumped into the inner room. Omerna was becoming more useless every day for some reason. Leaving his reports with Balwar was bad enough, nonsense as they were, but even Omerna knew better than to hand one of these tubes with three red stripes to anyone but Niall himself. He held the tube close to a lamp to examine the wax. Unbroken, before his thumbnail pierced it. He would have to light a fire under Omerna, put the fear of the light into him. The fool was no good as a decoy unless he played the consummate spymaster as far as he was able. The message was from Varadin again, Niall's private cipher in that mad, spidery scrawl on a strip of thin paper. He almost burned it unread, then something at the end caught his eye. Beginning at the beginning, he consciously worked the cipher in his mind. He wanted to be absolutely sure. Just as before, it was gibberish about Aes Sedai on leashes and strange beasts, but right at the last, Varadin had helped Asadim Faizar find a hiding place in Tanchico. He would try to smuggle Faizar out, but the Forerunners kept such a guard that a whisper could not pass the walls without permission. Niall rubbed his chin in thought. Faizar was one of those he had sent to Taraban to see if anything could be salvaged. Faizar knew nothing of Varadin, and Varadin should know nothing of Faizar. The Forerunners kept such a guard that not a whisper could pass the walls. A madman's scrawl. Stuffing the paper into his pocket, he returned to the antechamber.
Balwar, what is the latest from the west?
Between them, the west always meant the border with Taraban.
No change from before, my lord. Patrols that penetrate very deeply into Taraban do not return. The worst trouble near the border is refugees trying to cross.
Patrols that penetrated too deeply. Taraban was a pit, writhing with poisonous vipers and rabid rats, but...
How quickly could we get a courier to Tanchico?
Balwar did not even blink. The man would not show surprise if one day his horse spoke to him.
The problem will be fresh horses once he crosses the border, my lord. Normally I would say 20 days there and back, perhaps a few less with luck. Now, twice that with luck. Maybe twice that just to reach Tanchico.
A pit that could swallow a courier and not even leave bones behind. There would be no need for a return, but Niall kept that to himself. Let it be arranged, Bulwer. I will have a letter ready in an hour. I will speak to the courier myself.
Bulwer bowed his head in assent, but dry-washed his hands at the same time, insulted. Let him be. There was a small chance this could be done without exposing Varadin. Unnecessary precaution if he was insane, of course, but if not, revealing him would not make anything happen faster. Back in the audience chamber, Niall studied Varadin's message once more before holding the slip in a lamp flame, watching it catch. He crumpled the ash between his fingers. He had four rules concerning action and information. Never make a plan without knowing as much as you can of the enemy. Never be afraid to change your plans when you receive new information. Never believe you know everything, and never wait to know everything. The man who waited to know everything was still sitting in his tent when the enemy burned it over his head. Niall followed those rules. Only once in his life had he abandoned them to follow a hunch. At Jamara, for no reason but a tickling at the back of his head, he had set a third of his army to watch mountains all said were impassable. While he maneuvered the rest of his forces to crush the Mirandians and Daltarans, an Ilianar army that was supposed to be 100 miles away came out of those impassable passes. The only reason he managed to withdraw without being crushed was a feeling. And now he felt that tickling again.
I do not trust him, Talonvor said firmly. He reminds me of a young sharp I saw at the fair once, a baby-faced fellow who could look you in the eye and grin while he was palming the pea from under its cup. For once, Morgays had no difficulty holding her temper. Young Piter had reported that his uncle had finally found a way to smuggle her out of the Fortress of the Light, her and the others. The others had been the rub. Torwin Barshaw had claimed himself able to get her out alone long since, but she would not leave them behind to the mercies of the White Cloaks, not even Talonvor. I will make a note of your feelings, she said indulgently. Just do not let them hinder you. Do you have a saying that fits, Lini? Something for young Talonvor and his feelings? Light, why did she take such delight in taunting him? He came close to treason, but she was his queen, not... The rest of the thought would not come. Lini sat near the windows, rolling a ball of blue yarn from the skein Brianna held stretched on her hands. Piter minds me of that young undergroom just before you went to the White Tower, the one who got two maids with child and was caught trying to sneak away from the manor with a sackful of your mother's plate. Morgaze's jaw hardened, but nothing could spoil her pleasure, not even the glance Brianna gave her, as if she should be allowed to state her opinion as well. Piter had been overjoyed at Morgaze's impending escape. Of course, part of that was because he apparently expected some sort of reward from his uncle for his part. At least a few of his comments suggested it, something about making up for a failure back home. But the young man practically danced when she agreed to the plan that would have them all out of the fortress today and out of Amador by sunrise tomorrow. Away from Amador and on the road to Gildan, where soldiers would not come with strings to tie to Andor. 2 days ago, Barshaw himself came to unfold the scheme, disguised as a shopkeeper delivering knitting needles and yarn, a squat, big-nosed man with a choleric eye and a sneering mouth, though the words came out respectfully enough. It was hard to believe him Piter's uncle. They looked so different, much less a merchant. Still, his plan was a marvel of simplicity, if hardly dignified, needing only enough people outside the fortress to make it work. Morgays was going to ride out of the Fortress of the Light, buried in the bottom of a cartload of kitchen refuse. "Now you all know what to do," she told them. So long as she herself was in her rooms, the rest could move about with considerable freedom. Everything depended on that. Well, not everything, but certainly every escape but her own. Lini, you and Brianna must be in the laundry yard when the bell sounds high. Lini nodded complacently, but Brianna gave her a pursed-lipped look. They had been over this 20 times. Even so, Morgays was not going to allow a mistake to result in anyone being left behind.
Talonvor, you will leave your sword behind and wait at an inn called the Oak and Thorn. He opened his mouth, but she forestalled him firmly. I have heard your arguments. You can find another sword. They'll believe you mean to return if you leave it. He grimaced, but finally nodded. Lam Gwyn is to wait at the Golden Head, and Basil at... A hasty tap at the door, and it opened enough to admit Basil's balding head.
My queen, there's a man, a child.
He glanced over his shoulder into the hall.
There's a questioner, my queen.
Talonvor's hands went to his sword hilt, of course, and he would not take them away until she had gestured twice and grimaced at him beside.
Admit him?
She managed a calm voice, but butterflies the size of foxes fluttered frantically in her belly.
A questioner?
Was everything that suddenly had been going so well about to turn just as suddenly to disaster? A tall, hawk-nosed man pushed Basil out of the way and closed the door in his face. The white and gold tabard with the crimson crook on his shoulder gave his rank as Inquisitor. She had not met Einor Saren, but he had been pointed out to her. There was a set of unalterable certainty to his face.
"You are summoned to the Lord Captain Commander," he said coldly. "You will come now."
Morgaze's thoughts raced faster than the butterflies. She was used to being summoned. Niall did not come to her, now he had her in the fortress. Called before the man for another lecture on her duty to Andor, or for what was supposed to be a friendly chat, to show her that Niall had her best interests, and Andor's at heart. Used to that, but not to this sort of messenger. If she was being given over to the questioners, there would be no subterfuge. Asunawa would send enough men to drag her away and everyone with her. Him she had met briefly. He made her blood freeze. Why had an inquisitor been sent? She voiced the question, and Saren replied in the same icy tones.
I was with the Lord Captain Commander, and I was coming this way. I have finished my business, and now I will take you back. After all, you are a queen. Due respect.
That all sounded slightly bored, somewhat impatient, until the last, when a note of wry mockery entered. No warmth, though.
Very well, she said. Shall I accompany my queen?
Talonvor bowed formally. At least he made a display of deference when any outsider was around.
No.
She would take Lam Gwyn instead. No, any of the men would make it seem she thought she needed bodyguards. Saren frightened her nearly as much as Asunawa did, and she would not let him catch even a hint of the fact. She put on a casual, tolerant smile. Surely I need no protection here? Saren smiled, too, or at least his mouth did. He seemed to be laughing at her. Outside, with Basil and Lam Gwyn looking at her uncertainly, she almost changed her mind about attendance. She would have, had she not spoken inside. But two men could not protect her if this really was some elaborate trap, and changing her mind would be a show of weakness. Walking through the stone corridors beside Saren, she certainly felt weak, not like a queen at all. No, maybe she would scream like anyone else if the questioners had her in their dungeons. Well, there was no maybe about it. She was not fool enough to believe royal flesh different from any other in that regard. But until then, she would be what she was. Deliberately, she set about flogging down those butterflies. Saren led her into a small flagstone-paved courtyard where bare-chested men were hacking at wooden posts with swords.
"Where are we going?" she demanded.
"This is not the way I have gone to the Lord Captain Commander's study before. Is he somewhere else?"
"I take the shortest way," he replied curtly. "I have more important matters to see to than—"
He did not finish. And he did not slow, either. She had no choice but to follow, down a corridor lined with long rooms full of narrow cots and men often bare-chested, or in less. She kept her eyes fixed on Saren's back, composing the blistering sentences she meant to deliver to Niall. Across a stable yard, the smell of horses and dung heavy in the air, and a farrier shoeing horses in one corner, along another barracks hallway, and then one with kitchens down one side, and the thick smell of stew cooking, into another courtyard. She stopped dead. A long, high scaffold stood in the middle of the yard. Three women and over a dozen men filled every space, hands and feet bound, nooses snugged around their necks. Some wept piteously. Most only looked terrified. The last two men on the far end were Torwin Barshaw and Piter, the boy in his shirt sleeves instead of the red and white coat she had made for him. Piter was not weeping, but his uncle was. Piter appeared too horrified to think of tears.
"For the light!"
a white cloak officer called out, and another white cloak shoved a long lever at the end of the scaffold. Trapdoors snapped open with loud cracks, and the victims fell from sight. Some of the stretched ropes quivered as those at the end choked their lives away instead of dying quickly from a broken neck. Piter's was one of those, and her fine escape died with him. Perhaps she should have had as much concern for him, but it was the escape she thought of, her way out of the trap she had walked into, herself trapped, and Andor with her. Saren was looking at her, plainly expecting her to faint or sick up. "So many at once," she said, proud of the steadiness in her voice. Piter's rope had stopped jerking. It only swung slowly from side to side now. No escape.
"We hang dark, friends, every day," Saren answered dryly. "Perhaps in Andor you release them with a lecture. We do not."
Morgaze met his gaze. The shortest way? So this was Niall's new tactic. It did not surprise her that no mention had been made of her planned escape. Niall was too subtle for that. She was an honored guest, and Piter and his uncle had been hanged by chance for some crime that had nothing to do with her. Who would be the next to mount the gallows? Lamgwyn or Basil? Linny or Talanvor? Strange, but the image of Talanvor with a rope around his neck hurt more than the image of Linny. The mind played peculiar tricks. Over Saren's shoulder she caught sight of Asunawa at a window overlooking the scaffold. He was staring down at her. Maybe this was his doing, not Niall's. It made no difference. She could not let her people die for nothing. She could not let Talanvor die. Very peculiar tricks. Arching an eyebrow mockingly, she said, "If this has unhinged your knees, I suppose we can wait until you find your strength again." A light voice, not affected at all by what she saw. Light, let her not vomit. Saren's face darkened, and he turned on his heel and stalked away. She followed at a stately pace, not looking up at Asunawa's window, trying not to think of the scaffold. Perhaps it really was the shortest way, for in the next corridor Saren led her up steep flights of stairs, delivering her to Niall's audience chamber more quickly than she remembered making the journey before. As usual, Niall did not rise, and there was no chair for her to take, so she was forced to stand before him like a petitioner. He seemed distracted, sitting silent and staring at her, but not really seeing her. He had won, and he did not even see her. That irritated her. Light! He had won! Perhaps she should return to her rooms. If she told Talanvor and Lamgwyn and Basil to carve a path for her, they would try. They would die, and so would she. She had never held a sword, but if she gave that command, she would take one up. She would die, and Elaine would ascend the Lion Throne. She would, as soon as Althor could be pushed from it. The White Tower would see that Elaine got what was hers. The Tower. If the Tower secured the throne for Elaine. It seemed mad, yet she trusted the Tower even less than she did Niall. No, she had to save Andor herself. But the cost. The cost must be paid. She had to force the words out. "I'm ready to sign your treaty." Niall hardly appeared to hear at first. Then he blinked and suddenly laughed wryly and shook his head. That irritated her, too, pretending surprise. She had not tried to escape. She was a guest. She wished she could see him on a gallows. He moved into action so quickly that he almost dispelled the memory of his earlier apathy. In moments he had his dried-up little secretary in with a long parchment, everything already written out, and even a copy of the Seal of Andor she could not tell from the original. Choice or no choice, she made a show of reading the terms. They were no different than she had expected. Nile would lead the White Cloaks to regain her throne, but there was a price, if not named as such. 1,000 White Cloaks quartered in Camelin with their own courts of law outside Andorran law in perpetuity. White Cloaks to stand equal with the Queen's guards throughout Andor in perpetuity. It might take her lifetime to undo signing this, and Elaine's as well, but the alternative was Al Thor with the Lion Throne as a trophy. If any woman ever sat on it again, it would be Elaenia, or Nian, or one of that ilk, and as Al Thor's puppet. That, or Elaine as the Tower's puppet. She could not make herself trust the Tower. She signed her name clearly, pressed the copied seal into the red wax that Niall's secretary dripped at the foot of the sheet. The Lion of Andor surrounded by the rose crown. There. She was the first queen ever to accept foreign soldiers on Andorran soil. How soon? It was harder to say than she had imagined. How soon will your legions ride? Niall hesitated, glancing down the table. There was nothing there except pen and ink, a sand bowl and a freshly burned down stub of sealing wax, as if he had very recently written a letter. He finished scrawling his signature on the treaty and impressed his own seal, a flaring sun in golden wax, then handed the parchment to his secretary. Put this in the document room, Balwer. I fear I cannot move as quickly as I had hoped, Morghese. There are developments I must consider. Nothing that need concern you. Simply a matter of how best to move in areas unrelated to Andor. I insist you take this as simply more time for me to enjoy your company. Balwer bowed smoothly, if somewhat prissily, yet she was almost certain his eyes nearly jerked toward Niall in surprise. She herself nearly gaped. He pressed her and pressed her, and now he had other matters to consider? Balwer scurried out as though afraid she might try to snatch back the treaty and tear it up. But that was the furthest thing from her mind. At least there would be no more hangings. The rest would be dealt with when it could be. One step at a time. Her dogged resistance had failed, but now she had time again, an unexpected gift not to be wasted. The pleasure of her company. She put on a warm smile. It seems as though a weight has lifted from my shoulders. Tell me, do you play stones? I am accounted a fair player. His answering smile was surprised at first, then amused. Morghese flushed, but managed to keep her face from showing anger. Perhaps it was best that he thought her broken now. No one watched a broken opponent too closely or regarded them too highly, and if she was careful, with time she could begin recovering what she had given away before his soldiers left Amadicia. She had had a very good teacher in the game of houses. I will try not to provide too poor a match, if you would like to play. She was well beyond fair herself, perhaps even beyond good, but she would have to lose, of course, though not so badly that he grew bored. She hated losing.
Frowning, Asinawa drummed his fingers on the gilded arm of his chair. Above his head, the shepherd's crook was worked in brilliant lacquer on a pure white disc. "The witch was taken aback," he murmured. Sarn answered as though it was an accusation. "Some people are affected that way by hanging. The Dark Friends were rounded up yesterday. I'm told they were chanting some catechism to the shadow when Trom broke down the door. I checked, but no one thought to ask if they had any connection to her." At least he did not shift his feet. He stood as straight as any hand the light should. Asinawa dismissed explanations with a slight wave of his hand. Of course there was no connection, aside from the fact that she was a witch and they dark friends. The witch was in the Fortress of the Light, after all. Still, he was troubled. "Niall sent me to fetch her as if I were a dog," Sarin grated. I almost spewed up my stomach standing so close to a witch. My hands wanted her throat. Asunawa did not bother to respond. He hardly heard. Of course, Niall hated the hand. Most men hated what they feared. No, his mind was on Morgay's. She was not weak, by all accounts. She had certainly fended off Niall well enough. Most people would have collapsed as soon as they were inside the fortress. She would ruin some of his plans if she turned out to be weak after all. He had all the details in his mind. Each day of her trial, with ambassadors on hand from every land that could still produce one, until finally her dramatic confession, wrung from her so skillfully no one would ever find a mark. And then the ceremonies surrounding her execution. A special gallows just for her, to be preserved afterwards to mark the occasion. "Let us hope she continues to resist Niall," he said, with a smile that some would call mild and pious. Even Niall's patience could not last forever. Eventually, he would have to hand her to justice.
Chapter 32. Summoned in Haste. To Egwene, Rand's visit to Cairhien seemed like one of those grand illuminators' fireworks displays she had heard of but never seen, exploding all through the city. The echoes seemed to reverberate without end. She did not go near the palace again, of course, but wise ones that went every day to search for traps laid with Sidar told her what went on. Nobles stared at one another with slitted eyes, Tyran and Cairhienin alike. Berylaine seemed to have gone into hiding, refusing to see anyone she did not have to. Ruark apparently took her to task for neglecting her duties with small effect. He appeared to be the only one unaffected in the whole palace. Even the servants jumped if you looked at them, though that might just have been having the wise ones themselves poking into every corner. In the tents, things were no better, among the wise ones anyway. The rest of the Aiel were like Ruark, calm and solid. Their attitude made the wise one's moodiness even more tense by comparison, not that it needed any. Amis and Cerulea came back from meeting Rand all but hissing. They did not say why, not where Egwene could hear, but the feeling spread through the wise ones as fast as thought, until every one of them stalked about like a bristling cat, ready to claw anything that moved. Their apprentices stepped lightly and spoke softly, but still were scolded for what would have passed without notice before, and punished for what would have brought only a scolding. Shido wise ones appearing in the camp did not help. At least Therava and Emerys were wise ones. The third was Savannah herself, striding around self-importantly with her blouse unlaced enough to rival Berylaine, no matter how the dust blew. Therava and Emerys said Savannah was a wise one, and though Cerulea grumbled, there was no choice but to accept her as one. Egwene was sure they were spying, but Amis merely looked at her when she suggested it. Protected by custom, they had a free run of the tents, welcomed by all the wise ones, even Cerulea, as if close friends or first sisters. Still, their presence honed the edge of everyone's mood, especially Egwene's. That smirking cat Savannah knew who she was, and took no pains to hide her delight in sending the short apprentice girl to fetch a cup of water or the like at any opportunity. Savannah looked at her, too, a studying sort of gaze. It made Egwene think of someone studying a chicken, thinking how to cook it after they stole it. Worse than that, the wise ones would not tell her what they talked about. It was wise ones' business, and none of apprentices'. For whatever reason the Shido were there, the mood among the other wise ones certainly interested them. More than once Egwene saw Savannah, when she thought herself unobserved, smile as she watched Amis or Malinda or Cosane stalk by, talking to herself and needlessly adjusting her shawl. No one listened to Egwene, of course. Too many comments about the Shido women finally earned her most of a day spent digging a hole deep enough to stand in without being seen. And when she climbed out, all sweat and filth, to begin filling it in, Savannah was watching. 2 days after Rand left, Aeron and some other wise ones talked three maidens into sneaking over the wall of Arilin's palace in the night to see what they could scout out, and that made everything worse. The three avoided Gawain's guards, if with more difficulty than they expected, but the Aes Sedai were another matter. While they were still climbing from the roof into an attic, they were wrapped up in the power and whisked inside. Fortunately, Coiran and the others seemed to think they were there to steal, though the maidens might not have thought it was so fortunate. They were tossed into the street, so bruised they could hardly walk, and still struggling not to sniffle when they got back to the tents. The other wise ones took turns upbraiding Aeron and her friends, usually in private, though Cerulea appeared to make a point of confronting them before as many people as possible. Savannah and her two companions sneered quite openly whenever they saw Aeron or one of the others, and speculated among themselves in very audible voices about what the Aes Sedai would do when they found out. Even Cerulea looked at them askance for that, but no one said anything, and Aeron and her friends began walking as small as the apprentices. The apprentices began trying to hide when not actually performing their duties or taking lessons. Sharp tempers became like razors. Except for her hole, Egwene managed to avoid the worst of it, but only because she stayed away from the tents a good deal, largely to stay clear of Savannah before she taught the woman a lesson. She had no doubt how that would end. Savannah was accepted as a wise one, no matter how many grimaces there might be when she was not around. Amis and Bear would probably let the Shido woman set her punishment. At least staying away was not too difficult. She might be an apprentice, but only Cerulea made any effort to teach her the thousand things a wise one had to know. Until Amis and Bear gave her final permission to return to Tel Iron Riod, her days and nights were largely her own, so long as she managed to escape being snapped up with Saranda and the rest to wash dishes, or gather dung for the fires, or the like. She could not understand why the days seemed to pass so slowly. She thought it must be waiting on Amis and Bear. Gawain was at the Longman every morning. She became used to the fat innkeeper's suggestive smirks, though once or twice she did think of kicking the woman. Maybe three times, no more than that. Those hours went by in a flash. No sooner did she sit on his knee than it was time to straighten her hair and leave. Sitting on his knee no longer frightened her. Not that it had ever frightened her exactly, but it had come to be more than pleasant. If she sometimes thought things she should not have, if those thoughts made her blush, well, he always brushed her face with his fingers when she blushed, and said her name in a way she could have spent a lifetime hearing. He let slip less about what was going on with the Aes Sedai than she learned elsewhere, and she could hardly make herself care. It was the other hours that dragged out as though mired in mud. There was so little to do that she thought she might burst from frustration. Wise ones keeping watch on Arilin's mansion reported no more Aes Sedai. Chosen from those who could channel, the watchers said the Aes Sedai were still wielding the power inside day and night without break. But Egwene did not dare go close, and if she had, she could not have told what they were doing without seeing the flows. Had the wise ones been less snappish, she might have tried to spend time reading in her tent. But the one time she touched a book except at night by lamplight, Bear muttered so about girls wasting their days lying about lazily, that Egwene murmured that she had forgotten something, and scurried out of the tent before she was found something more useful to do. A few moments' conversation with another apprentice could be as dangerous. Stopping to talk with Saranda, who was hiding in the shade cast by a tent belonging to some stone dogs, earned her an afternoon doing laundry when Cerulea found them. She might actually have been glad of chores, just for something to do, but Cerulea examined the perfectly clean wash hung inside the tent to keep off the ever-present dust, sniffed, and told them to do it again. Twice she told them to do it again. Savannah watched part of that, too. Being in the city always made Egwene look over her shoulder, yet on the third day she picked her way down to the docks, as cautiously as a mouse stealing from a cat. A wizened fellow with a narrow little boat scratched his thinning hair and demanded a silver mark to row her out to the sea folk's ship. Everything was dear, but that was ridiculous. She fixed him with a level stare, told him he could have a silver penny, still far too much, really, and hoped the bargaining would not take her whole purse. She did not have much. Everybody jumped and flinched at the Aiel, but when it came to bargaining they forgot all about Cadinsor and spears and fought like lions. He opened his toothless mouth, closed it, peered at her, then muttered under his breath, and to her surprise told her she was stealing the bread out of his mouth. "Get in," he grumbled. "Get in. I cannot waste all day for a pittance. Brow-beating a man, stealing the bread." He went on like that even after he began working the oars, pulling the tiny boat out onto the broad waters of the Alguenya. Egwene did not know whether Rand had met this wave mistress, but she hoped he had. According to Elaine, the dragon reborn was the sea folk Coramore, the chosen one, and all he had to do was appear to have them running at his beck and call. She hoped they did not grovel too much, though. Rand got more than enough of that already. Still, it was not Rand that sent her out with the muttering boatman. Elaine had actually met some of the Atha'an Mier, had traveled on one of their ships, and she said sea folk windfinders could channel, some of them anyway, maybe most. That was a secret the Atha'an Mier held close, but the windfinder on Elaine's vessel had been more than willing to share her knowledge once her secret was penetrated. Sea folk windfinder knew weather. Elaine claimed they knew more of weather than the Aes Sedai. She said the windfinder on her ship had worked enormous flows to produce favorable winds. Egwene had no idea how much of that was true and how much enthusiasm, but learning a little about weather would certainly be better than twiddling her thumbs and wondering whether being caught by Nasuna might be a relief from the Wise Ones and Savannah. With what she knew now, she could not have made it rain if the skies were black except for lightning. At the moment, of course, the sun burned golden in a cloudless sky, and heat shimmers danced over the dark water. At least the dust did not make it far onto the river. When the boatman finally drew in his oars and let the small craft drift beside the ship, Egwene stood up, ignoring his mutters that she would have them both in the river. "Hello," she called. "Hello! May I come aboard?" She had been on several river boats and was proud that she knew the right terms. Ship folk seemed touchy about the right words, but this vessel was outside her experience. She had seen river craft longer, a few, but none so tall. Some of the crew were in the rigging or clambering up the slanted masts, dark, bare-chested men, barefoot in wide, colorful trousers held up by bright sashes, dark women in bright blouses as well. She was just at the point of shouting again, louder, when a rope ladder uncoiled down the side of the ship. No answering call came from the ship, yet that seemed invitation enough. Egwene climbed. It was difficult. Not the climb, but keeping her skirts decently close. She could see why the sea folk women wore trousers, but finally she reached the rail. Immediately her eyes fell on a woman not a span away on the deck. Her blouse and trousers were blue silk with a darker sash. She wore three worked gold earrings in each ear, and a fine chain that supported tiny glittering medallions ran from one to a ring in her nose. Elaine had described this, and even demonstrated using Telairan Riod, but seeing it in the flesh made Egwene wince. But there was something else. She could sense the ability to channel. She had found the windfinder. She opened her mouth, and a dark hand flashed in front of her eyes with a gleaming dagger. Before she could scream, the blade sliced through the ropes of the ladder. Still clinging to the useless thing, she plummeted. She did scream then, for all of a heartbeat, before she went into the river feet first, plunging deep. Water rushed into her open mouth, drowning her scream. She thought she swallowed half the river. Frantically, she struggled to unwrap her skirts from around her head and rid herself of the ladder. She was not in a panic. She was not. How far down had she gone? It was all muddy darkness around her. Which way was up? Iron bands gripped her chest, but she breathed out through her nose, watching the bubbles stream, as it seemed to her, down and to her left. Twisting, she stroked for the surface. How far? Lungs burning. Her head broke through into daylight, and she sucked in air with a coughing gasp. To her surprise, the boatman reached down and hauled her into his boat by increments, muttering at her to stop thrashing before she upset them, adding that sea folk were a touchy lot. He leaned over again to reclaim her shawl before it sank once more. She snatched it from him, and he shied back as if he thought she meant to hit him with it. Her skirts hung heavily, her blouse and shift clung, her headscarf slanted across her forehead. A pool began to form in the bottom of the boat under her feet. The boat had drifted maybe 20 paces from the ship. The windfinder was at the railing now, and two more women, one in plain green silk, the other brocaded red worked with gold thread. Their earrings and nose rings and chains caught the sun.
"You are refused the gift of passage," the green-clad woman called, and the one in red shouted, "Tell the other disguises do not fool us. You do not frighten us. You are all refused the gift of passage."
The wizened boatman picked up his oars, but Egwene pointed a finger straight at his narrow nose.
"Stop right where you are."
He stopped, dunking her. Not a word of common courtesy. Drawing a deep breath, she embraced Sidar and channeled 4 flows before the windfinder could react. So she knew weather, did she? Could she divide her flows 4 ways? Not many Aes Sedai could. 1 flow was spirit, a shield she shoved onto the windfinder to keep her from interfering. If she knew how.